Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720, and we're paying tribute for the rest of the show to Fast Eddie Ho, Chicago drummer, born 1944 in Forest Park, died November 7th, 2015 in a Westmont nursing home. Our band and Eddie fans, what you heard there was Mike Medina on drums and vocals, you'll hear later, Donnie Briggs on Fender Strat, Bill Picara on Fender Jazzmaster, and Dan Moore on the Hofner President. Okay, so tell us about Eddie. Michael?
The story of Eddie is one of those. It was the more I looked into, you know, a drummer whose name I'd seen on a couple albums that I had, you know, Monkees Records mostly. And you'd look and find that his name was on some other things that you really, really liked. And the more that I looked into him, his story, it just kind of ended, you know, like you never saw his name after
the 70s, the early 70s.
It dropped off, and you know, the quality of the playing and what he was doing on those records would lead you to believe that it was an older professional studio guy a la Hal Blaine or, you know, Earl Palmer or one of those guys. And when you looked into it, you know, I did the research into it. I kind of was curious over the years, and I found out that he was a young guy. He was a peer of the guys that he was playing with, but the quality of his playing is just so tremendous, it belies his age. And you know, then you find out that you know what happened to him, and that's the story is incredible.
Tell us about the track you just played called Stop. I mean, I kind of wanted to start the show with that segment with that. I mean, it kind of goes back to some of his maybe Rush Street roots and blues, and tell us about that track.
Yeah. That song is off of an album called Super Session. It came out in the late 60s, and it was credited to Mike Bloomfield and Steven Stills. And Eddie was the drummer on that, along with Barry Goldberg. Was the keyboard player on a few songs. Harvey Brooks is bassist, and Al Cooper, you know, was kind of put it all together. Eddie and Barry and Mike go back to the early 60s here in Chicago, when Barry and Eddie used to play together in like a band on Rush Street at a place called Tony Paris's Show Lounge on Walton Street. You know, skinny ties, shiny suits, playing twist music. This is very early 60s, and they're, you know, 17, 18 years old. It's kind of like the Beatles Hamburg thing, where that was their, you know, that was the forge that they had to go through, playing all these sets, and there's, you know, famous people hanging out and you know, make show kind of thing. So they all met there, and when that album came out, they had already been friends and playing together for a number of years.
I was thinking about this. I've been thinking about this all day. I'm really excited about talking about this. Is that where, I mean, Fast Eddie, I mean, was he, you know, I read stories about him. He pounded out beats on a table. Do you think the Rush Street thing maybe informed his showmanship?
Absolutely.
What have you learned about that?
Absolutely. His playing, his professional playing days go back one band even before he was in high school, with a couple guys, Russ Vestuto and the Heartbeats, and they had singles out. He was in high school, and they had 45s out. By the time about 63, when he started playing on Rush with the band was called Robbie and the Troubadours, he had already been a professional drummer, and kind of that amalgam of things that were going on in Chicago, culturally and music wise, really, you can hear that in his playing. You can hear he's playing the blues. So he's obviously going to blues clubs with Mike and Barry. He's got some show tune background stuff in, you know, in his playing, and it's all a country. You know, it's all those things that were going on here. It's all internalized. And, you know, when he got out to California to play at, you know, 22, 23 years old, he could do it, no problem.
Yeah. We're going to take a break for the news, and we're going to come back. I want to talk about Chip Douglas, and we're going to come back with – that's the Monkees connection, so I'm excited we're going to come back with Pleasant Valley Sunday.
All right.
So don't go away.
The local rock group down the street is trying hard to learn that song. They serenade the weekend squire who just came out to mow his lawn. another Pleasant Valley Sunday. Charcoal burning everywhere. Rows of houses that are all the same, and no one seems to care. See Mrs. Gray, she's proud today because her roses are in bloom. Mr. Green, he's so serene, he's got a TV in every room. Another Pleasant Valley Sunday. Here in Steady Simple Land, mothers complain about how hard life is, and the kids just don't understand. The creature comfort goes, they only numb my soul, make it hard for me to see. My thoughts seem to stray to places far away. I need a change of scenery. Another Pleasant Valley Sunday. Charcoal burning everywhere. Another Pleasant Valley Sunday. Here in Stanislaus.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. And that's on vocals, Dan Moore and Mike Medina. And we're doing our tribute to Fast Eddie Ho. I just like saying Fast Eddie.
Yeah, it's pretty great, isn't it?
Sounds great. So tell us about his connection with the Monkees and Chip Douglas. And we explained who Chip Douglas
sure.
was.
Chip Douglas was a producer in the 60s, but before that he was in a folk, it was a four-piece folk band called the Modern Folk Quartet. With Cyrus Farriar, Jerry Yester, and Henry Diltz. And
photographer.
Yeah, who became a photographer. He wasn't at the time. Right. He was just their banjo player. About 1965, as folk music kind of became electric, they decided to do the same, and they hired Eddie to play drums. And
now, the Monkees had a lot of... I mean, they had Hal Blaine in the studio, and then Mickey was the touring...
Right, the face
of the drummer. Yeah.
So... After the Modern Folk Quartet kind of went away, Chip was approached by Mike Nesmith to produce, and their first album where they did it themselves, it was kind of, you know, you can tell Mickey's kind of learning how to play drums. The second one that he said, well, I've got this drummer, I'm going to bring him in, and it's Eddie Ho. And it would be like the Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and
Right,
Jones
I brought
album.
That in. I hope maybe sometime before the show's over, we can play a little bit of Going Down, which is just really a great example of this.
So that was how Eddie ended up in the Monkees, you know, realm of being on those records. And it kind of, when Chip was producing other stuff, Eddie was kind of his go-to guy. Again, he's existing in the realm, you know, he's 22, 23. He's existing with Hal Blaine, who's 15 years older than him. You know, it's incredible.
How did the whole band get together? I mean, was it all a common love? I mean, this is such an obscure story. did you learn about him? Did you know about him before you got together in this group? Is this the first time you guys have all played? I mean, you know, why are we all here?
Oh, yeah. Well, we've been playing for years.
And this is
My name's Donnie Griggs. Okay. Yeah. I met Mike 20 years ago at a rockabilly festival in Indianapolis, Indiana. And, I mean, from the get-go, I mean, we liked the rockabilly, but we loved everything. It turned out we loved the Monkees, we loved the Beatles, Buddy Holly. Through Mike, I met Dan, and from Dan I met, or from Mike, I also met Bill.
I mean, it's. I mean, I was over looking at Drummer World. I'd like to know. Mm-hmm. This is on a post on Drummer World. This is March 2008. I'd like to know why a drummer that's played on so many famous recordings is completely obscure. I've tried and tried to find pictures. His notable session drumming, the Monkees, super sessions. Why was he so obscure?
Well, it's kind of part of the mystery is that just as fast as his star was on the rise, because you know he left Chicago in about 64. And by 69 and 70, he disappeared. And what I came to find out within the last year by talking to his friends and his family is that he mental illness really took hold, I think, around that time. I'm not sure exactly if it was induced by anything or it was just, you know. But the story that I heard was, you know, he had some sort of a breakdown and pretty much moved back to Chicago and was in and out of facilities kind of most of the rest of his life, institutions or not, or just kind of on his own. But he had family and friends that took care of him, looked after him, but essentially his professional playing days were done.
It became he became kind of mythical. I mean, there was one post about how he drove his motorcycle into Lake Michigan.
Right.
Tell us about Denny Doherty of the Mamas and Papas, wrote in his biography in 2002 that he had died.
Yeah, Denny Doherty thought he was dead. Al Kooper, I think, thought he had died. Most of the West Coast people, I think, when he left California to come back to Chicago, and they never heard from him again, just assumed, you know, that the downward slide that he was on when they knew him there was nowhere else to go but his passing, you know. When I encountered him, when I got to meet Eddie in early, about a year ago, I was so enthralled afterwards that I wrote to as many of his former bandmates and stuff as I could. I wrote to Henry Diltz. I wrote to, you know, Jerry Yester. I wrote a letter to Michelle Phillips from the Mamas and the Papas, and put it in the mail, didn't think I'd hear back, and months later I got a card in the mail. I just told her, you know, I found Eddie Ho, he's alive, you know, he's doing well, you know, I just thought you'd like to know. And she sent me a card in the mail, and it's, you know, it was incredible.
Yeah, read us what she said.
It says, so happy to hear about Eddie Ho. Don't know how that rumor got started, which I'm assuming she's meaning that he's dead. Hope he is well and happy and still banging away. Thank you for letting me know. It makes me happy. All the best, Michelle.
Yeah.
Where did you
meet him? Where'd you go? Where'd you find him?
I met him in one of the homes he was in. It had been about January of 2015, and I met him through a gentleman who also met him at that facility, who had posted on some internet boards that I had frequented over the years, kind of looking for, you know, does anybody know where Eddie Ho is? And this gentleman's name is Ken, wrote on there, like, I met Eddie Ho. I know him. I see him all the time. He didn't really know who he was, you know, kind of in passing, but in researching the same thing, finding out all these incredible things that he had done musically. And so Eddie, through Ken, would answer questions. People would write to Ken, and Ken would ask Eddie, what did you play on in this? How did you come up with this?
And he was Eddie lucid?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was, you know, it was... He was just an old, you know, older gentleman, just, you know, slightly hard of hearing, and
just,
you
like
know.
Me, just like me.
So it was funny because, you know, when I met him, we stood up and I said, you know, it's nice to meet you, sir, and he said, it's nice to meet you, sir, and it was one of those moments where we're both calling each other sir, and we're both standing at the table waiting for somebody else to sit down first. You know, really, like, well-mannered. Like, immediately I could tell it was, like, a Chicago guy.
Yeah.
You know, like, shakes your hand, nice to meet you, you know, just a pleasure, you know, to be around in that.
And
in
where
that
was way. He at? Was this in a nursing? What,
yeah, it was
in
a
suburb?
Or was out, Itasca at the time. And I wasn't I'm not sure where he was before that. I don't know how long he had been at that place.
Did he know you were a drummer? You are a drummer?
No, I had to tell him.
You had to tell him?
Yeah, and, you know, part of it was, you know, we talked about he gave me some tips on
playing. Yeah, what did he tell
you? We talked about, you know, he said, you know, you want to change your snare drum rim, the top rim, to something slightly bigger because you have to work less to get rim shots on it. He said, you know, I did this and, you know, tuning, stuff like that. And, you know, it was really cool because I knew so much about the era and the music of the era that I was able to ask, really hone in on kind of obscure things and ask him about people that he knew and places he'd seen. Wow. And places he played.
Did he know people thought he was missing in action?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, how did he feel about that?
I think we asked him. I asked him about that, and I think his response, if I'm remembering right, was something like, "Well, no, I've been here the whole time." You know, just like that. Like, no, I'm alive.
Did you go to his funeral?
I did.
Or what was that like?
It was really nice. It was. I got to meet his family and his friends, and you know, I told him kind of who I was and you know, my interest and things like that, and it was. The things that we talked about was just a kind soul, kind of like making his way through the peaks and valleys of what he was going through, and there were some really wonderful things, you know, on a personal level that everybody kind of shared.
He was on the now some stuff I read, and you're gonna play Christine's song, the first formation of the Fine Burrito Brothers.
Yes.
Now some of the stuff I read there, they said he was kind of messed up on drugs and stuff.
At that time,
the stuff I read is falling off the chair and things
right,
like that.
Right, right.
I mean,
so I don't know.
Was it mental illness or drug use?
I'm not sure.
You're my only window into this.
I know. Yeah. I you know that them saying that leads you to think it's drug use of some sort. I never went down that road with anybody that knew. It's not really, you know, it's just kind of on his way out. What's interesting about this is that the album liner notes say that he played on two songs on the record, and when I asked him about it, he said, I didn't play on this, but I played on Christine's song. And so it kind of changes the discography a little bit, you uh-huh. know, like he's like, no, I don't remember playing on that. I remember playing this one and this one.
Wow. And we're going to take a break for some commercials, and we're going to come back and hear Christine's song here on WGN Nocturnal Journal. Don't go away.
Devil in the sky, you can't see it in her eyes. She's telling dirty lies. She's a devil. Now, a woman like that, all she does is hate you. She doesn't know what makes a man a man. She talk about the times when she's been with you. She speak your name to everyone she can. She's a devil in disguise. You can see it in her eyes. She's telling dirty lies. She's a devil in disguise. In disguise. When happiness has been a close companion, her world is full of jealousy and doubt. It gets her off to see a person crying. It's just the kind you can do without. She's a devil in disguise. You can see it in her eyes. She's telling dirty lies. She's a devil in disguise. In disguise. Her number always turns up in your pocket whenever you are looking for a dime. It's all right to call her, but I'll bet you the moon is full and you're just wasting time. She's a devil in disguise. You can't see it in her eyes. She's telling dirty lies.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. And that's 1969, Devil in Disguise, with the Flying Burrito Brothers.
Yes.
Right, Michael?
Fast Eddie Ho.
Real quick, we've got only a couple. I want to go around the table here and talk about other projects. But he also worked with Donovan.
Yeah, he worked with Donovan on the Sunshine Superman LP. And he did Season of the Witch on that, which is a phenomenal track. And
later covered by?
By on the Super Session album, Stephen Stills. So he played on both.
It's a fascinating story. Do you feel him when you play?
I do. It's you know, I picked up things that he did. I can always hear signature things he does when I listen to him. And you know, there's a couple of those things. If you listen to his stuff, you're like, I know that's Eddie.
Good for you to find this all out and keep this alive.
Oh, it's fascinating. There's tons of information out there finally, so, you know.
Well, thank you guys for coming in. I want to go around and reintroduce everybody. Dan Moore.
Howdy.
How are you doing? What do you got coming up? You're playing at one of our favorite honky talks close to the mic.
So I've got a project. Actually, all these guys occasionally stumble into, too, called Rosie and the Rivets. It's a vintage rock and roll show. We play all over the suburbs in the earlier we were talking, we're going to be at Miss Kitty's Saloon.
That's my buddy Mark Ibach's favorite hangout and stuff. When are you there? I saw it on the website.
We're going to be there St. Patrick's weekend, so I'm sure that'll be quite a trip.
And same type of music, kind of rockabilly?
Yes.
Okay. Donnie Briggs.
Howdy.
Yeah, what do you got coming up?
Not a whole lot. I mean, I moved to Michigan, so I'm kind of out of the loop things. The far eastern suburbs out in Michigan.
Another friend says, James McCool, a listener to the show, says you're the youngest Buddy Holly authority you've ever met.
Yeah. Probably so.
Bill Picara, Fender Jazz Master.
Yeah, I really don't have much going, so Dan, if you want to give me a call, I'm willing to come out. So.
You did tell us your dad... your dad's band won the Dex Card Battle of Bands.
Yeah,
Dex
Card,
a famous Chicago disc jockey.
Right,
tell us
like
about that.
1965, they had a garage band, Rolling Stones, Mike Bloomfield connection there.
Yeah,
and they got on a Battle of Teens, and they went all the way, and I think they won it. Yeah.
And Mike Medina, what do you got coming up?
Usually, things have kind of died off for me lately, but I do play with Rosie and the Rivets every once in a while, and it's good.
Things are going to change after people hear this show. So thank you all for it's been a fascinating show tonight. Thank you, Dan Long. Thank you, Aubrey Mumpower, for all the work back there with engineering. David Jennings for the news, and thank you for listening. We'll be back next week on Nocturnal Journal.